need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk. Now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com, and joining me on the other line, he almost dislocated his shoulder giving me a high five last night. It's Andrew Greenwald!
We watch sports. That's what you're talking about.
You got big Cody Bellinger energy.
Listen, people... I don't know what the Venn diagram is for people who watch playoff baseball but also listen to this podcast, but before we even get into the rundown, last night, Dodgers hero Cody Bellinger hit a big dinger in a crucial moment and then celebrated by throwing out his shoulder, by throwing it into another player. And I watched this with, like, honestly, I felt great, because what I wanted to express to our listeners is aging can be treacherous, you know, and there are things that you give up along the way. But the one thing that you gain is the rock solid confidence in the knowledge that you will never dislocate your shoulder by violently celebrating a home run.
No,
that's
we just do
off the table.
We just arm lock our takes. So today on The Watch, we're going to be talking about a little bit of, actually, the baseball comes up because I want to talk to you a little bit about the idea of passive TV watching. Okay. And I want to talk about my experience with Disney Plus's The Right Stuff, which I checked out, which ties into that. And we'll talk a little bit about the most recent episode of Fargo, which aired last night. So let's get
into
it.
And Good Lord Bird. We watched Good Lord Bird.
Good Lord Bird, right? No. Yeah. So let's get into the show.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. We're not all professional athletes, but we all have health goals. That's why Anytime Fitness gives you access to personalized plans and support from a coach. Plus, you can track your training, nutrition, and recovery progress with the Anytime Fitness app, just like the pros. With 24/7 access to more than 5,000 gyms worldwide, get more from your gym membership. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, restrictions all apply. See website for details.
All right, Greenwald, we're back. So yesterday was a great and long day of sports. Well, they weren't all great because the Eagles-Ravens game was tough for your boy. But I basically spent with some breaks for exercise, for conversation with my wife, for personal stock taking, but for the most part was on the couch watching TV from 10 to 10. More or less. Yeah. Because I watched from the Eagles through a couple of other football games. And then I think I watched Fargo, and then I watched the Dodgers game.
Do you have alerts set so that your wife can sort of rotate your body on the couch so that sores don't develop? Like, what is your...
You make me sound like the guy in Seven.
I'm concerned, but please go on.
I walked around. You can see. I mean, you can see that I'm looking better than I ever have.
It's true.
But something that occurred to me over the course of the, like, basically 12 hours of watching TV on and off, which was, you know, because it's live sports, you're not fast forwarding. You sort of start to find yourself slipping back into the way we used to watch TV, which is at the mercy of what was on at the moment. And while you could have some wiggle room with your DVR or whatever, for the most part, you couldn't, like, watch ahead or binge watch and grab three shows, and you couldn't have, like, six different streaming platforms open. And also, just like the experience of watching these playoff games is, until you get really annoyed, which happens somewhere around minute 47, you are kind of like half sort of watching commercials. And I think I texted you at some point during that Dodgers game, and I was like, commercials are fucking crazy now, man. They really are now split to either directed by Cary Fukunaga or a Crazy Eddie's commercial from 1984 where they're just like trying to hammer you home with like some price point for some product you don't need. So anyway, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, because I think you've had a little bit of an existential cloud over the show for the last 2 weeks or so, where we're just like, there's a lot to watch, but there's not a lot that's inspiring us. And I think that there's like a little bit of pressure because I think TV, since it's sort of moved into this, it can be both a world building, serialized, long form franchise, or it can be essentially a movie that is just happens to be sitting next to a TV show, or it can be a 27-minute groundbreaking dramedy that teaches us about what it means to be alive. It can be so many different things that this simple act of I'm just watching this box has kind of faded away. And yesterday was like, you know, I don't want to make it too, I don't want to make too tidy of a bow here, but it actually reminded me of sometimes the joy of getting up and walking into the other room for a snack and just being like, what did I miss? Did anything happen? You know, whether it's sports or whether it's something that you're actually watching, like a story.
Yes, I haven't watched TV in a long time.
Yeah.
I think that's not a surprise.
No, but the TV that we're talking about, like I'm watching Fox or I'm watching NBC for three hours.
And partly, you know, yeah, that's because of what we've been covering in the podcast, which is primarily on cable or streaming services. But also because I was just personally not ready to welcome sports back into my life, into my own personal pandemic bubble. I couldn't really find the space to do it this year, except I did want to watch Game 7 of the NLCS because I like baseball, and
the baseball is good. That has been a good series, and it's like it was an interesting series. And I still hate the Braves, so it's great.
That was really satisfying for both of us, I think. And I think that there was something deeply satisfying, pleasurable, but also comforting in exactly what you're saying, the rhythms of it. So for example, getting up. The politics of getting up during a prestige television show in a non-single household are fraught. Mm. They are deeply fraught.
Dude, yes, yeah. Yes.
I know. I don't want to name names, but one of the members of my household likes to get a snack after we've spent 45 minutes deciding what to watch and after the opening credits of whatever we've decided to watch.
Yes.
That's when the hunger hits.
So the opening credits hit, you're done with that. So you're not a skip intro person.
Well, no, great point. It depends. When it's something as lively as the French serial Call My Agent, well, we like watching it all the way through. But I'm saying maybe even it's a movie. You can't skip intro on a movie. So I'm just generally placing that's when the tummies rumble in chez moi.
I think we have the title for this podcast, Kyle.
So
when the tummies rumble.
But I'm only bringing that up to say that there was a moment when I was watching baseball when during the time of that game, when it was on, like I got up to get a snack. I'm not above such quotidian concerns, but I got up kind of near the end of the commercials, knowing full well that I would return to, at worst case scenario, 2-1.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like I wasn't going to miss anything that important. And similarly, just old familiar household rhythms, like your boy folded some laundry during the seventh inning. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like that felt very freeing. That's not a second screen experience, but that's how we used to experience television. And let me just say, overall, the greatest pleasure of it, not just saying this because I'm doing the podcast with you live right now, but we had some fun. We had some texts going.
We had some jokes at the expense of the Braves pitching staff.
Mostly their relief team.
And bullpen.
Their bullpen. I don't want to, you know, cast aspersions or make anything political, but I feel like they've definitely considered kidnapping some elected officials. Like maybe just lightly, you know?
Did they attend the Sturgis rally? Who is to say?
Who knows? I'm just saying that Plandemic is in their queue. It's just they're asking questions.
Well, I don't want to name names either. Separate from that, though, will you share with our listeners what Mark Melanson's Twitter bio is?
Are we sure how we're saying it?
Yeah, it's Mark Melanson.
Okay, I've never actually heard it out loud. Both Chris and I agreed that we thought that he was Mark Melancon.
He apparently was not. Yeah,
and he's not. We shouldn't really dunk on him because he lost the Dodgers last night along with the rest of his Braves
really
teammates.
Don't care.
But
I thought you were going to say something. We shouldn't dunk on him because he's actually like a great American who's like teaches public school in his part time.
He is a great American to me because I just feel while we're just doing this, like, you know, make TV great again, ode to the way things used to be, deeply conservative on many levels. I'd share with Chris that this pitcher's Twitter bio suggests a life that I would like to lead. And his Twitter bio is been known to dive with great whites and walk with cheetahs! !
Uh-huh.
Jesus believer, husband, father, strike thrower, and thrill seeker. I mean, that's the energy I want.
Yeah.
Post-pandemic. Like, I just feel so simple. It's like,
do you think that his wife and kids? Yeah. But like, is that like husband, father, thrill seeker are two competing impulses to me?
They are. He's quiet, quiet, loud. He's like a grunge song. You know what I mean? Yeah. And this dude sees a shark, he swims with it. He sees a cheetah, he runs with it. He sees a child, he parents it. And if he sees a goddamn ball, he throws the shit out of it. And like, that is so contrary to my experience on this earth that I love it.
Yeah.
But anyway, just to say that sharing some LOLs with a pal while watching something
that is live,
has also been kind of removed from, and I don't think it's just a podcasting thing where we have things on our viewing plate that we enjoy for the show. We have things that we watch on our own that we enjoy with our spouses. And then we have things that we admire that we watch for the show. And all of those present different, place different demands on your attention, but none of them really allow much room for just chatting and making it social. So all of that was really fun.
So I had the same experience where after the Dodgers game and I was like done for the evening, I started watching,
you weren't done for the evening. You started watching something else.
All I do is watch stuff. I don't gotta worry about anything else. You know, it's like I just watch stuff and I think about watching stuff and then I think about what I didn't watch and then I read a little bit. But you know, on a Sunday.
Have you considered running with cheetahs?
I just should throw some strikes. I watched a little bit of Haunting of Bly Manor, which I am almost done with, and which I've been enjoying quite a bit.
Wow.
But Haunting of Bly Manor is the exact opposite of what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Haunting of Bly Manor is not only is it very dark and is essentially rooted in the trauma of the characters in the show, but is that kind of blink and you'll miss it. There was a ghost in the back of the frame, you know, like that kind of Easter egg hunting, not strike throwing, Easter egg hunting. If I was Mark Melanson, right. I would be like, husband, no kids, Easter egg hunter.
It's less cool.
It's not as cool. But because of that sort of training that we've given ourselves, I think largely since Game of Thrones, although I also feel like Lost in 24, where like you cannot fucking get up. Don't miss any of this.
Yeah.
Except for commercials, obviously. But I feel like when I was watching House of Bly Manor, I would get up to go to the bathroom or to grab a drink of water. My wife Phoebe would just be like, you know, like you can't do this because you're actually missing like a crucial plot point in this show. Mm-hmm. And I was like, but we've been watching this show for the better part of 8.5 hours. And I feel like I've like as a 42-year-old adult have like earned the right to go grab a glass of water. Like I should be able to do that and not miss the entire thing explained to me. Now that's my own anxiety. That's everybody's own neurosis about like you have to watch certain things in a certain way. But I just thought it was really cool. Like I wound up watching the first episode of The Right Stuff on Disney today. And I know that story. I know that story from Tom Wolfe's book. I know that story from the Philip Kaufman movie. I know that story from just like years and years and years of having it repeated to you. And
I don't want to put you on the spot, Chris. And I know that I believe I know that he's been excised from this adaptation, but what would Chuck Yeager's Twitter bio?
Yo, man, fucking me and Sam Shepard are not looking on this happily. Just let me put it that way.
Justice for Yeager.
Yeah. No Chuck. And in some ways, I know that that is a really strongly held belief of yours that Chuck Yeager needs more representation.
Yeah, in the arts. Yeah. I do think that.
And so you'll be boycotting The Right Stuff because of it.
I got to find a reason to boycott it. And that's my chosen one.
But because I'm so familiar with the story of, I mean, you know, I wouldn't call myself an expert, but like I've watched enough stuff and read enough stuff that I feel like I got it. I know what happened. I was able to watch this show for pure pleasure. So I was able to watch it and also get up and grab a pretzel chip and then come back and be like, oh yeah, right. So this is Gus Grissom. This is Alan Shepard. This is John Glenn. Obviously NASA and its humble beginnings in an office in Langley. Like, got it. And it was like very expertly made, dude. I have to say, you know, the sets look incredible. Everything looks amazing. And each scene is just like, let's get in and out. What are we trying to say here? What's the, like, what is the most efficient way to do it to explain that Alan Shepard has some sort of psychic wound that he's trying to heal with drinking and women? What do we do about John Glenn, who is like drinking seltzer at the bar while the astronauts are drinking scotch? Like all this stuff. And it's just like, man, I really love sometimes feeling like I can look away from TV. And maybe that's a strange thing for us to discuss.
Well, I know we're saving a larger conversation about it for the...
We can make it all flow into one, though. Yeah, we can make it all happen at once.
But this makes me think of Fargo season 4.
Okay.
And we should say here, like, this is clearly, this is just us. This podcast is generally just us chatting. And so if you haven't watched these episodes, I don't know how spoilery we're going to get. We're going to just talking about them in general. If we start to say something more revealing and you're not caught up, we'll throw up a siren or something. But just to say, I wonder how much we are misweighting vibe. Hmm. Because you're talking about shows where you can sort of skip around and not miss anything. And I would say, with deep admiration and respect, Fargo season 4 is a show you could get up and leave the room and come back to. Because chances sure. are a character is sitting down and saying, you know what the deal with America is? And then monologuing for a while.
Yeah. And just so people know, no spoilers, Andy's not kidding. That is literally like two-thirds of the scenes are a discussion about the nature of the country.
And for what it's worth, my favorite basketball player of all time is Allen Iverson. So I know what it's like to watch and not only watch, root for an ISO offense where everyone just stands around and one guy dribbles a lot and goes to the hoop. Like, I get that. And side note, if it was Ben Whishaw doing that with just, I don't know, the actor equivalent of Dikembe Mutombo is just clearing out the paint, I would watch that for 10 hours. But my point being, what the show is servicing primarily, at least through 5 hours, and I got to be clear, 5 hours, like each episode is 59 minutes plus, is a very specific vibe. And the vibe is mob movie. You know, it's increasingly, it's a little bit Miller's Crossing because that is the Coen Brothers mob movie, but it's by far the least connected in my view to the Coen Brothers DNA. And it is giving you very, very primal thing that people who love mob stories like, which is, you know, the hothead gives a long speech and is he going to kill the guy or isn't he going to kill the guy? Spoiler, he's going to kill the guy. Mm-hmm. And that scratches a very popular itch, right? This is a show that, you know, fits in with the type of programming that we've been covering, which is to say that it deserves, and I'm not saying it doesn't deserve, full attention, cinematic consideration and respect as a prestige television show made by one of our prestige auteurs. But what I'm beginning to sense from a lot of these prestige programs, and there are others that we could name check here to talk about as well, maybe they're not that. You know, maybe they are TV where you can just kind of duck in and duck out, unless you are part of the 10% or whatever of the audience, that this is exactly what you want and you're vibing on it. And so for you, The Right Stuff, which has gotten mixed reviews, I haven't checked in with it, but it's gotten mixed reviews, but that is your vibe. You have always been a speed demon in the skies. And so for you, you plugged in and that it feels good, right?
Yes. And it's also a much more efficient scorer than Fargo. So I would say,
help me land this space shuttle.
So there's a couple of scenes in the most recent episode of Fargo that we can talk about without talking about the end of that episode explicitly until we like put up the spoiler sirens, that I think illustrate what I'm talking about. Now, there's plenty of things in Right Stuff where characters are essentially giving a glorified presentation of their own character breakdown. Like, you can almost imagine, like, this is what Mark Lafferty and Will Staples, who worked on The Right Stuff, like almost told the actor, like, this is what John Glenn is about. This is what Gus Grissom is about. This is what Alan Shepard is about. And you can just kind of like, you almost have these very illustrative scenes to just sort of be like, ah, that guy is a family guy or that guy is not. Mm-hmm. And once they get through those things, I feel like the story just has momentum. When you enter a scene, there might be a cool shot of like two guys standing, you know, there's like two guys standing in an empty kind of lo-fi office in Langley and they're like, welcome to NASA. So you get like a very clear picture of NASA's humble beginnings. But with Fargo, I feel like many of the scenes in that show are dedicated to, God, we got this framed up just right, man. So we're going to spend an extra 45 seconds or 3 minutes on these two guys perfectly backlit in the window of this classic American diner, standing in a way that no two people ever actually have a conversation, with the light streaming through the windows of this whited out Midwestern winter. And these two really good actors just delivering meaty monologues about, almost told entirely in anecdotes. You know what I mean? Like these sort of like, well, I have a story to tell you and I have a story to tell you. And then here is the fortune cookie of wisdom that we will extract mm-hmm. from these two stories. And I think that when you stretch that out over, like you're saying, 5 full hours, and it's just that, it's just character enters a scene and that entire scene seems to carry with it the weight of a feature film, then I just think that the dynamics of the show get really thrown off because there's no quiet loud, to go back to the grunge thing you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And I think that what we are bumping up against, this is a different kind of existential conversation than the I'm too much of a snowflake to handle extreme sadistic violence this close to an election, which is a conversation I'm still willing to have, but maybe we can lay off it for a week.
Yeah.
I wanted to bring in, there was this article that I had a lot of time for by Sonia Soraya in Variety. It was basically like, has peak TV peaked? And
was it in Vanity Fair or Variety?
I'm sorry, it was in Vanity Fair.
Yeah.
People should check this out. And the one thing, the one nit that I would pick with it is I think that we have, and I realize this is self-defeating on a number of levels for myself as a podcast host in search of material, as a former critic who contributed to some of this, and now as a creator who wants to still be a part of it. I just feel like the framing is challenging because I think we sometimes approach things this way in the podcast, but I think this article does as well, which is that TV is great. And this current crop of programming, or since the glut in production has only increased over the last few years, is somehow diluting that, that maybe it's just not nearly as great anymore. And I feel like it's worth as a contextual corrective to say for 90 years or 80 years, TV has been really mediocre. That is TV's calling card.
Uh-huh.
Like they've always made a shit ton of TV and most of it's not great.
Yeah.
And some of the not great stuff is fine, which is a different category.
Yeah.
It's fine because it's on and it's enjoyable and it's your shows and you can... It could be Days of Our Lives, or you can
Caroline in the City, or whatever. Yeah,
or trick yourself and say it's Grey's Anatomy, which is scratching similar itches and doing it expertly for it's well into its second decade at this point, right? I think that I don't necessarily know that we're owed greatness. I think that what's changed and what TV definitely hasn't figured out yet is how to be great and still be TV, rather than just be great for people whose dreams were not realized in movies and are now being realized by flush streamers who
I actually think there's
a lot of cash.
And this is the thing that I would actually push back on than what you just mm-hmm. said, is that I used to think, I think maybe circa 2013, 14, when True Detective came out, mm-hmm. where I was like, truly a real cinematic artist has been married with what I considered to be a very good, great writer for that first season. I know you disagree. And this is the result. Is this?
I think he's great on Instagram.
He's on one. He's having an incredibly normal one on Instagram. Mm-hmm. Shout out to Nick. The marriage between Fukunaga and Pizzolatto's stuff, I thought, like, introduced this cinematic energy to television that I don't know that I had fully recognized in another show before then. And then since then, it was like the directors are coming. Right, the directors are coming, mm-hmm. and they're going to make TV even more beautiful to look at and more artistically worthwhile to savor, while still being able to tell stories in this long form way. And they're no longer the restriction of we got to turn the theater over in 90 minutes, and all of these great adult dramas and thoughtful comedies and interesting genre experiments that no longer get made by the movie studios because they're just in blockbuster territory. They can all come to TV, quote unquote, but. Now, I think the result of that is not quite, it's cinema, but told over the course of 6 hours. It's this new beast. It's like whatever came out of the lab is this kind of, more often than not, kind of bloated, but also not actually as provocative visually as you would expect, given how often gorgeous it is. You know, how often it's like, wow, you guys definitely got an incredible cinematographer and great production design and great set design and great sets or whatever. But it's actually like, I don't know what I'm being told by the visual language that you're using here.
Well, let me put it in even more contemporary terms, which is that during this pandemic, certainly in Los Angeles, I know in a lot of the major cities, restaurants are closed for indoor dining. And one of the results of that, to support them or to stay alive, many of the very best restaurants, we'll just speak to this city, but I know it's happening elsewhere, have converted themselves on the fly at great expense and labor into takeout operations. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to do my part because I want to save restaurants because no one else in the government is. So, you know, getting really wonderful food once or twice a week from really wonderful restaurants. But I'll say something about really wonderful chef-y food. Mm-hmm. There's a reason you go to the restaurant to enjoy it. Much like there's a reason why you go to the theater to enjoy something expensive, sumptuous, and limited. Because when you bring the food home and it's calibrated for an evening out with all everything else turned up to 11, and I'm not talking, I know I'm mixing metaphors, but I'm not talking about the Dolby Surround Atmos system or whatever in the theater. I'm talking about the drinks you're drinking, the volume in the room, the excitement, the attention you're paying to every detail.
Sharing it with other people, yeah.
That all figures into the intensity of the experience. When you bring home food, which has been beautifully prepared and then put into a paper box and put onto your table with, you know, with a tablecloth with a stain on it or whatever, and on your plates. And yet the seasoning and everything and the ingredients are still super, super high end and intense. Something feels off.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like the calibration is off. Like it tastes too salty. It's like not if you, too if salty, you, if but you it's get too
a,
much.
If you get a steak from one of these restaurants that you're talking about, mm-hmm. it's still pretty good. They still probably cooked it with an entire stick of butter, and they did it their way, the way restaurants make steaks, where you're just like, what did you guys do this?
And they're spooning the butter on. They
did it. They did the great job. But when you get it home, even if you live like 6 minutes away from the place, it's still not as good as when they bring it right out of the broiler and put it on your table.
And this is the moment we're kind of in with television, where we are being given these sumptuous, almost indulgent resources. And they're being served to us in the same takeout boxes in our homes. And something is slightly off. And
so is that television or is that our perception of what life is like now? Because we have just been kind of having this simulacrum.
I know. I think that, you know, this is falling back on some arguments that we've made before, but I'll say them again, that like, I just don't think it's worth comparing today's moment, 2020's prestige television, to 10 years ago, because the thing that separated Mad Men or The Sopranos or what have you from the Comey rule mm-hmm. or whatever is that Mad Men and Sopranos are TV shows.
Yeah.
They were made by people who had worked in TV for a long time, who broke story in familiar ways and invested in character and long-term development over multiple seasons. The Comey rule is it's a completely different thing. I don't mean to pick on that, but I think that Sonia Brott mentioned that in her article. So that's why I'm using that as an example. You know, it's cinematic. There are stars doing weighty things, trying to tell you something important in a very limited amount of time. It's just simply not even attempting to do the same thing. And increasingly you'll notice, like, outside of Succession, what other shows in 2020 are just TV shows?
No,
I know everybody's trying to be either a movie or and look, I made an anthology series. I get it. You know, it's very alluring from a creative point of view to be like, I'm just going to leave it all in the field and tell this whole story and dazzle you over however many episodes. But it's not just that we've lost some of, and this is something I talked to Eric Kripke, the Boys showrunner, about during the interview last week, because he's made maybe more hours of television than anyone else this century because Supernatural, which he created,
Supernatural,
15th and final season. You know, he was basically like, I was like, what skills are we losing here? Because he's like, look, I'm fundamentally, he had a lot to say about what he feels the Boys is accomplishing politically and, you know, what he wants to say about the culture. But he's also like, I'm a carny. My job is to entertain people. And that's fundamentally what I do. And that's why I do things like bottle episodes or road trip episodes or whatever. And I think we're at this strange point right now where we, and I say this as consumers and podcasters and maybe even as creators, we are definitely prioritizing breaking the mold over the mold.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. We're not all professional athletes, but we all have health goals. That's why Anytime Fitness gives you access to personalized plans and support from a coach. Plus, you can track your training, nutrition, and recovery progress with the Anytime Fitness app, just like the pros. With 24/7 access to more than 5,000 gyms worldwide, get more from your gym membership. Visit anytimefitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, restrictions all apply. See website for details. This episode is brought to you by Jiffy Lube. Cars can be a big investment, so it's important to take care of them. I once got a car that I started out with 25,000 miles on. I got it to over 200,000 miles because I took care of it. You know how you take care of a car? You take care of the maintenance, the oil, the brakes, all that stuff. And if you don't, you can have a car just completely fall apart. When your car needs maintenance, head to Jiffy Lube. They provide automotive excellence at speed. Get your oil changed, brakes checked, tons of other multi-care services. It's all done by expertly trained technicians who actually care about taking care of you and your car. Jiffy Lube, car more. To find coupons and start an instant online estimate, visit JiffyLube.com. This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on Cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on Cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on Cars.com.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
The thing that you're describing is exactly about The Sopranos is exactly how I felt watching Borgen on Netflix. Okay. So we talked about this last week a little bit in our grab bag of recommendations, but this is a Danish political drama that aired, I mean, I guess like about 10 years ago, I think, and is on Netflix now. And they're actually bringing the cast back, I believe, to do another season of it. And I've been watching it, and it's, you know, critically lauded show, so it's not like I'm not discovering anything here. But the thing that's been wild about it is the value of the episodes of Borgen. Like, I cannot believe how tight they can do. Will she pass this finance bill? That's the episode. And now, the guy who maybe got excommunicated from her cabinet or from her political operation might come back. And the TV host, is she pregnant and whose baby is it? And what's going on with her? There's A, B, C, D plots. There's other stuff going on. There's like a larger portrait of democracy or parliamentary democracy in action or whatever. But essentially, there is a point to the episode. And I think that a lot of TV I watch, and I actually have, I think, a lot of mixed feelings about Fargo. I think the way we've been talking about it makes it sound like I'm like so out on it. But like, I actually do love Ben Whishaw. I love parts of it. But I can't help but feel like some of Fargo winds up culminating in the last 45 seconds of the episode. Like that is actually, that's what the episode is about, mm-hmm. is whatever the thing is at the very end that makes you feel like, well, I guess I got to watch next week.
And the rest is vibe.
Mm-hmm. That's not what Borgen's like. That's not what The Sopranos was like. That was story. That was.
And so what I'm curious about is, what are we doing here? Because one of the main lessons of the streaming revolution is that people fucking love television. What I mean by that is they love television in large numbers and to a large degree the way they have always loved television. And whether that means using the pandemic to rewatch Breaking Bad, as people I know are doing, or whether it means using it to rewatch Parks and Recreation, mm-hmm. as I know they're doing, or to get familiar with Succession, like, people want their stories. They want their stories. And people who make TV. I mean, this goes back to David Chase. It goes back well before him. I mean, remember, David Chase didn't want to make TV anymore, and he was frustrated making The Sopranos. Everybody wanted the golden ticket out of making TV so they could make movies and be more creative. And the last 10 years, people who made TV won the lottery, right? Like, you can still work in this highly lucrative field, but you can do whatever you want. And everyone was like, great, I'll take it. Good reason to do it. And it's produced some incredible, incredible achievements over the last few years. But I have to think the people, you know, certainly Netflix too, like, I think when Netflix signed Ryan Murphy to hundreds of millions of dollars, they essentially, that's carte blanche, right? Whatever you want. And one of the things that made him very appealing is that he's a high volume creator. He's prolific. Makes a lot of shows.
Yeah.
But I have to think what they were really hoping they were going to get out of him was high volume anthologies like American Horror Story, but more specifically, like, could you do Nip Tuck again? Like, a show that'll run for a bunch of years that people will like to watch. And I'm very curious about Shonda Rhimes' new shows for Netflix because she's so good at doing that and people want that. And so is that what will she just use these new resources to make elevated versions of the types of beloved shows that she's made in the past? Or will she be like, great, bet, I'm done with this. You know, yeah, like now right. I can do what I want and make origin stories for characters in 50-year-old movies like Nurse Ratched. Or, you know, like that's the eternal question for me. And so I wonder if we will look back on this time. And I think it'll take some kind of conversation-grabbing, norm-rattling show to get everybody on board with this. But I have to think that in boardrooms and backrooms, people are saying, like, you know, like at the end of Back to the Future, like, we got to go. Like, we got to fix this.
Yeah.
You know, we got to start making TV shows again because...
I think that's a really good point about, like, this idea of norm shattering, because I think that was, and if you'll forgive me for bringing this up, kind of what I liked about Ted Lasso so much is that...
forgive me. Well, everyone says that around me now.
I thought that it subverted certain tropes of a quote-unquote workplace sitcom in really intelligent, non-fussy ways. Mm-hmm. So... characters who you would have just been like, that's going to be the heavy and they must be vanquished, wound up being absolutely lovable. And characters that you were like, this guy has to like remain the butt of the joke or the punchline and can never be the sentimental heart of it. They subverted that because
I feel like you just described my arc on this podcast and then your arc on this podcast. It was beautiful.
But you know what I mean? Like, I think you can still find that out there, but those guys never lost sight of making a really sweet, entertaining show. And I don't think a lot of people maybe start from, hey, the number one thing is to make a really super entertaining TV show for people, whether it makes them laugh or cry or whatever, like, let's keep it that and then start messing around with it.
I'll say, you know, I can't get too specific about details, but one of the challenges that I've been facing over the last few weeks and months is the project that I'm working on. I've gotten further and further into the weeds with it. Is this contemporary problem? Not to say that I have solved it, because I certainly haven't, but the challenges of the project I'm working on are that it has a enormous hook. It has a limitless possibility, I think, for storytelling. It also has to because this is what I care about, has to be a personal character-based story.
Well, you mean you've always loved Greedo, you know? I mean, he's always meant a lot to you.
That's right. And so the first season is really an extended pilot, I think, for what will be his origin story.
kind of an origin of the origin story.
It's called Greedo : First Shots. And playing on, you know, anyway.
Kind of like Hamilton.
But in many ways, like the beloved American musical Hamilton, I have chosen a great misunderstood leader and retold his life through song. Well, through rap, really. No, just that the challenge is in, you know, 50 minutes, 60 pages or whatever, accomplishing seven things and setting the table for future hours to come. Very few people can do that successfully. You know, I mean, I'm trying. I hope it goes well. Damon Lindelof can do it. I'm not sure who else can do it, you know? And I think that Well, I mean, I guess we'll see, not just in terms of my project, but I think in terms of what the types of shows that people will be checking for in the years to come, or even what's getting ordered. If you have your spec, I guess I'll put it this way. If there are people who are listening who are trying to break in, write your big serialized drama. Like, try that now. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
don't take your giant stakes sci-fi spec script and be like, well, I'm just going to use this script as the story document for seasons 1 through 3.
Right.
Write the TV show, right. You know? Not just because that's what we want to cover, but I do think that we're missing that. And I think the calibration has been a little bit off. And part of that, yeah, is the entrance of directors or big budgets or big expectations, but also this idea that TV, because it is elastic, you could make it a 2-hour or you could make it a 20-hour, that it somehow can be everything mm-hmm. all the time, all at once. And I think that we're running up against the limits of that.
Do you think Good Lord Bird is good TV?
I struggle with it. It's a great question. I really am enjoying the show.
Yeah, you're one episode
really
ahead,
admiring
ahead of me
the
right
show.
Now, yeah.
And speaking of our beloved Hamilton, David Diggs shows up in the third episode as Frederick Douglass. He's great. And I think the thing that struck me about this again is it's not TV. You know, I think that's kind of what I wanted to say about it. There's a big set piece at the end of the episode. This is not spoiling anything because this isn't really a show that can be spoiled except by history, where Onion is in Frederick Douglass's office stealing a drink. And then both of Frederick Douglass, the women in his life, his wife, and then a German woman who was rumored to be a mistress, but in the show, and I believe in the book, fully presents her as like his sister, like sister wife. Like he basically has two women.
Yeah.
And then through a series of hijinks, he has these dramatic, sexually charged scenes with both women while Onion is hiding under a desk, but they're aware that he's there. And I was like, well, this isn't TV. This is theater.
Yeah.
This is just fully, not just because Ethan Hawke's involved and David Diggs, but like this was just theater. They didn't even try to be like, what's, you know, we're not trying to make it as if we are, you know, the camera is looking in on things that could actually happen. We're just watching a scene play out and it's theater. It's enjoyable. It's a different vision of a time in American history with its own energy. It's not a TV show.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean I don't like it, but
is there a TV show in there though? Is there a version of this that is a TV show? I guess is what I'm asking.
I mean, look, part of this is, you know, these are champagne problems as a viewer, because you can go to the all night bodega that is our streaming service menu and be like, tonight I'm going to pull this out of the deep freeze. I'm in the mood for this, or I could watch something else. So I don't want to say, I think that we will look back on this time and be like, look at all these deeply idiosyncratic, interesting, creative enterprises that were greenlit during this era and feel like this is actually incredible. I mean, you know, part of that brain is the same brain that was just like, oh, the famous band's worst album from 1976 is their best because it's more interesting and less known. Like this might be that era in a weird way for TV. But yeah, like I think the thing is there's probably an incredible TV show set during this incredibly fraught time, just while everything was simmering just before the American Civil War popped off, right? But that show, you're not going to get Ethan Hawke and David Diggs in it for multiple seasons. You know, you're not going to get direction of this caliber, necessarily a budget of this caliber for location shooting or people like Steve Zahn or Wyatt Russell just willing to drop by as a favor. It's going to be something different, you know, and not necessarily better or worse, but different. And then final thing, just since we're bringing in just stuff we've been watching.
Yeah. Well, can I ask one thing about Good Lord Bird? Because you mentioned Ethan Hawke is not going to sign on to do this for the Showtime, the Showtime deal of you can get out, but you could never leave.
I think Dexter.
There's a way in which Good Lord Bird could just be like a Wagon Train or like a 50s, 60s TV Western, where it's like this group of people are moving from town to town or place to place in this area at this time. And they pick some characters up along the way and they leave some characters behind along the way. And essentially every week is a new stop. That's how it's structured. It has the bones of a 50s or 60s Western, but it has the prestige, to get back to the original thing here. It has the sort of coat of paint on it that's like, yeah, but something really fucking important has to happen here in the next 4 hours.
But it's told in vignettes too, which kind of de-escalates that feeling of like, I need to watch all this because it's building to one thing and one thing alone. One thing I would like to talk, I mean, maybe we could get Nick Grad from FX or John Landgraf back on just to chat about this one thing in particular, because I'm curious what their attitude about all this is, because I think I've mentioned a couple times we've been watching What We Do in the Shadows, which is just a great comedy, the FX vampire comedy. And one of the things that I really, really admire and respect about it is that when you turned on the first episode, if you did, and chances are maybe you'd heard of the movie that it was inspired by or loosely based on, that Jermaine Clement and Taika Waititi made. Maybe you knew those two names, from Jermaine from Flight of the Conchords or Legion or whatever, or Taika, I guess, had made the Thor movie at that point, which was his biggest global success. But if you turned it on, the odds of you recognizing any of the people in the show are slim to none, unless you were a fan of like the single funniest show ever made, Garth Marenghi's Dark Place, which is only available on YouTube, and Matt Berry was in that. But in one day we'll talk about that in full, because I've been revisiting it. But you don't know who any of these people are. What you do know is the very familiar but special pleasure of being like, oh, now I know who these people are. They're fucking incredible.
Yeah.
These parts.
Absolutely. You know what I mean? Discovery. Yeah.
The discovery. And I'm like, now I'm into their vibe.
No, it's like, that's like the feeling you get when you saw like Happy Endings, where you're just like, holy shit, this group of people were made for each other. You know what I mean? Like that feeling where it isn't like this was put together in a spaceship hovering over the CAA building, and this person decided that they were ready to do TV for 6 months, whatever. I mean, and you can still get that and have that cinematic vibe. I felt that way about Mindhunter. You know what I mean? Like, you can still pull people together and put them in this perfect position where you're like, I can't believe Groff is doing this. But more often than not, it's like, man, Ethan Hawke, he really crushed that. Ethan Hawke was gonna fucking crush that.
I can't believe I'm saying this about Fincher, considering there's no one more capital C cinematic in Fincher, but of all the shows that have been like, we're movies, but we're also TV, Mindhunter is a TV show. That's why it's great.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's just a great TV show that happens to have these incredibly high values. But bringing it back to Succession, I don't know if we commented on this specifically on the podcast, because we've made a fair number of comments over the years. But when the cast was announced for the Adam McKay pilot, Succession, I remember being like, oh, okay. We'll see. Yep. Jeremy Strong had just done The Big Short, and he was great in that and turned a lot of heads. So that felt like that's kind of traditional TV, or at least in the last 10 years, like pick the guy on the come up or the woman on the come up and grab them under the 7-year contract while you can, you know. Brian Cox is famous and a name, but he's not a household name. And Kieran Culkin, I was like, okay, well, he's always pretty good, but what are we doing? Never heard of Sarah Snook. But that's why the show is good. That is, you can't, I mean, I don't want to figure out the exact percentage of why, but like, why Mad Men? We didn't know who John Hamm was. He was that guy.
Right.
That is part of the secret sauce of making a really successful long-running television show.
Same with Gandolfini, same with Cranston. I mean, Cranston was Malcolm in the Middle's dad.
It's like,
we
don't expect him to be this.
Right.
And that is a unheralded secret sauce that has fallen away. And by the way, will continue to fall away because money is tight and finances are strange and consolidation is coming. And so just to get in the door, you have to be like, yes, this is a television show based on a podcast and Will Ferrell and Paul Rudd are attached, which by the way is The Shrink Next Door, the show that went straight to series at Apple. That's how you get in the door at the meetings now. You know, I think it is extremely hard to do it the other way, but I wonder, as the consolidation and all this is happening and roiling the industry, whether someone will look at the bottom lines and be like, let's try a couple the old way and see what we can and see how, what we can do here. Because, you know, again, bringing it all the way back to Fargo, this is painful for us to say because we adore him and he's the greatest stand-up comedian of our generation, even though he's a little older than us. But Chris Rock isn't great on the show, right? Like that's something, I didn't know if we were ever going to actually say it.
He's not. I thought, if it was going to happen, it was going to happen in this episode. And I was trying to put myself in the headspace where I'm like, since I fucking adore this guy, like what is he doing here that I'm not understanding? You know what I mean? Like, I was giving his performance the benefit of the doubt. And I just think that this was an episode where a fair amount happened and there's a lot of scenery chewing. And I actually, you know, there are other performances that I find a little bit more trying than Chris Rock, specifically the Gaetano character. But, you know, I just happen to think that Glenn Thurman and Jason Schwartzman and Ben Whishaw, and even though she's doing the most, Jesse Buckley, are just, they're just a little bit more like in the character. And Chris seems to be reading the lines. I don't know. I mean, that's just my take on it.
Well, I think what I would say is to fold this into the larger conversation, there's just a pretty big imbalance right now in television. And part of it is, you know, I've made this comparison before, but a little bit like the way movies got, where you had to have a big star and a package and they sell it on the poster. I mean, the blockbusterization of television continues. But the way I'd like to phrase it here, or to frame it, is I 100% know why Chris Rock is doing Fargo season 4, and I admire it. I love it. It's great. I'm happy for him to have an opportunity like this, to try something different. I mean, to have as much success as he has had, and then to be like, no, bring it on. Let's keep challenging. Let's go for it. That's what you want in people you admire. That's what you want in artists. Yeah. Similarly, I know why Ethan Hawke is making The Good Lord Bird, because look at him out there.
Yeah.
Look at him out there scrapping and yelling and mixing it up, you know?
It's got Method Man's You're All I Need contacts in.
he's got Method, that's for sure. I like The Good Lord Bird more than I like Fargo season 4, but I connect him in the sense that I absolutely understand why all the creative teams involved went for it. But in terms of the long-term success rate here of shows that are where the weight, it's a little more weighted on like, I get why the stars are doing this, or I get why the network is doing this, or I get why the agencies who package this, although we're not packaging anymore, thank you WGA, are doing this, and less why I, Joe Popcorn on the couch eating an overpriced steak, why I am doing this. Do you get what I mean?
Hey man, that's what the podcast is for, to figure that out. What a nice little chat.
We're just asking the questions. You know what I mean?
No, this is good. Because, you know, like the last couple of weeks, I feel like we've been very episode and show, very Catholic about being like, in this episode, this happened, and this is what we're going to talk about. And we've had a couple more wide-ranging conversations, but I wanted to hit a bunch of this stuff in a chat. So I'm glad we did.
Are we done? Is that the end of our chat?
That's it. That's
the end of the group chat.
I'll see you on text when we get into the World Series.
God, yeah, sports. We're going to do sports. Should we pivot this podcast to sports?
Just as they're all ending? Sure.
Listen, I make this comment to you frequently, but I just think that I continue to have my pulse on the finger of this country.
You do.
The night, Chris, that many people were watching the new Aaron Sorkin film, or checking out new shows that were on Netflix, like that Grand Army show, or maybe watching Game 6 of the NLCS. I was watching Gillian Anderson's proto-feminist masterpiece, the 1979 Australian film, My Beautiful Career. And, you know, that's when they zig, I zag.
Nobody puts baby in a corner. Like, yeah. Yeah.
Criterion Channel is getting a lot of burn in my household.
You're one of a kind.
Despite the snack interruptions.
All right, man. I'll talk to you on Thursday. We're going to finish up third day and we'll have a few other things to hit. So happy Monday. Keep it real.
Great chat, Branson.